This is Fresh Air. In the early 60s, the poet Maxine Cumin and her family fell in love with a fallen-down, overgrown 200-acre farm in central New Hampshire. After lovingly restoring the house and barn, they moved in the late 70s and made it their home. Cumin was raised in Philadelphia and was living in Boston at the time. Maxine Cumin is also a novelist and essayist. Her writing is inspired by her life in the country, tending her garden and breeding horses. Women, Animals, and Vegetables is the title of her newest book. It's a collection of essays and stories about her intense relationship to the natural world around her. Here's Maxine Cumin reading from the opening of her new collection. It's a poem called The Word.
We ride up softly to the hidden oval in the woods, a plateau rimmed with wavy stands of gray birch and white pine, my horse thinking his thoughts happy in the October dapple, and I thinking mine and his, which is my prerogative, both of us just in time to see a big doe loft up over the four-foot fence, her white scut catching the sun and then releasing it, soundlessly clapping our reveries shut. The pine grove shivers as she passes, the red squirrels thrill, announcing her departure. Come back, I want to call to her, we who mean you no harm. Come back and show us who stand pinned in stopped time to the track, how you can go from a standing start up and over. We, on our side, pulses racing, are synchronized with your racing heart. I want to tell her, watch me mornings when I fill the cylinders with sunflower seeds. See how the chickadees and lesser red-breasted nuthatches crowd onto my arm, permitting me briefly to stand in for a tree, and how the vixen in the bottom meadow I ride across allows me under cover of horse scent to observe the education of her kits, how they dive for the burrow on command, how they reemerge at another word she uses, a word I am searching for. Its sound is O-shaped and unencumbered, the see-through color of river, airy as the topmost evergreen fingers, and soft as pine duff underfoot where the doe lies down out of sight. Take me in. Tell me the word.
What does country life offer you then as a writer?
Well, it isn't just as a writer. As a writer, of course, it offers me a great deal. It's been my place. It's been the source of inspiration and a lot of hard work. But it's just the lifestyle. It's knowing that you can open the door and put your feet out on ground. I mean, I am horrified by the thought of living in, let's say, an apartment in a high rise and having to go down in elevators and out into traffic. I just am a country person all the way, and I'm a little bit of a recluse, although I think my family knows this better than the outside world. It's a standing joke in the family that you can't get me past the mailbox unless it's on a horse or behind a horse. So it gives me that kind of contemplative time.
You write that stormy days are the best writing days. Mm-hmm. Why so?
Well, because I don't have that other compulsion to go and do something useful with a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or something like that. And I feel justified in spending leisurely hours thinking things through, perhaps picking my way through some failed worksheets of poems and so on.
But do you feel torn between your animals and your writing?
I frequently feel torn between them, yes.
Feeling that if you're writing, you should be riding,
exactly.
And if you're writing, you should be writing.
Exactly. This is the fate of the Calvinist.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, salvation through grace and grace through good works. And so one is always looking about for evidence of good works, whether it's clean stalls and scrubbed out water buckets or answered correspondence or a structured draft of a new work.
So are you marked as a Calvinist?
I'm afraid I am a Jewish agnostic Calvinist to the core.
How did that happen?
I guess it was bred into me. I'm not sure. People frequently ask me why I'm so addicted to horses, and I have no answer for that either.
Well, I was going to ask you that exact question because I certainly have people in my family who love horses with all their heart. Did you ride horses before you moved to New Hampshire?
Yes, I rode as a youngster on those, you know, sad old school horses that livery stables rent out, and I was only permitted to ride once a week. But I made up for it by spending hanging out at the stable every possible moment and learning to clean harness and learning how to clean out stalls and learning how to groom and all of those other things. I always used to say that had my parents gratified my adolescent desires and yearnings for horses, I might have gotten over it and turned into a normal adult.
Well, what are those desires about, though?
I think to be the custodian of these creatures and to live in a situation where you can constantly observe them. It isn't so much the actual physical riding or driving, although certainly I enjoy that, but I get an enormous amount of pleasure and insight just in observing my horses at liberty. I mean, you know, until you've seen two horses relate to each other and stand there grooming each other, until you've seen them bucketing around when the wind comes up and they're feeling really good, you just haven't appreciated the aesthetics of the horse.
More from Maxine Kumin in a few moments. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and poet Maxine Kumin. When did you begin to write poetry?
I think I started to write poetry as soon as I could read and write, about age, 7 or 8.
What did you write about?
Well, I think the first poem I ever wrote was a little piece about a robin. Can it be that spring is here? It started. It was very imitative.
Do you remember the rest of it?
Can it be that spring is here? Hark, oh, what is that I hear? It cannot be, but yes, it is the robin's cheer.
So you were writing about nature from the
get-go? Yes, I was. Isn't that amazing? It's surprising looking back. I went through I wrote my way through grammar school, junior high school. Then I pretty much stopped writing in college because it was not really looked on with favor at the time that I was an undergraduate. You were there to amass learning, not to create. And I went back to the writing of poetry shortly after I was married, but I was very much a closet poet for a long time. I had 3 kids before I returned openly, overtly, and seriously to the writing of serious poems.
Well, I understand that a professor at Radcliffe, where you went to college, said to you after you gave him some poems to read, quote, "Say it with flowers, for God's sake. Don't try to write poems about it." Is that true?
That's true. I was 17 years old. I was devastated by that. I did find out later that he pretty routinely said that to young women who dared to hand him sheafs of poems. I'm sure that the comment was richly deserved because they were very romantic and very imitative. And it probably didn't do me any harm as a poet to have a period of long dormancy. By the time I returned to writing poetry, I was really ready for a kind of a new education and a new outlook.
So do you think he did you a favor even if that wasn't his intention?
Very possibly a backhanded favor. I wouldn't recommend it, however, to anybody who's listening and teaching.
Well, you've taught it at a number of universities. How have you either encouraged or maybe discouraged aspiring poets?
Well, I try not to discourage because I don't think anybody knows what a 17 or 18-year-old is going to be capable of 3 or 4 years down the road. I think that anything you can say or do to encourage creative thinking and creative writing is really a requirement of being a good teacher.
You described yourself as a closet poet for many years. Does that mean you rarely showed your poems, or?
Right. I didn't show them at all for many years. It was a secret activity.
Do you know why?
I think I was embarrassed to be writing poems. I think I felt it was a little bit outré. It was frowned on. It wasn't an acceptable activity.
Did your parents know you wrote poetry?
Well, I don't think my parents spent much time thinking about it. They knew that I was a sort of intellectual, or as they were known in those days, a brain trust.
That's the phrase?
That was the phrase that I was, yes, tagged with.
Well, you say that as if that's a terrible thing to be.
Well, I don't think so at all. I think it's a wonderful thing to be. But at the time, in my peer group, it was not a wonderful thing to be.
Does that mean you had to hide your brain power?
It was better to be
power?
A cheerleader.
Oh, did you aspire to that?
I didn't really aspire to cheerleading because I thought it was not possible for me. And so I, you know, went out for the school paper and that sort of thing.
But did you feel you had to keep your brain trust hidden?
I did, in order to maintain any status at all in the peer group. And I think kids face that all the time.
There's another quote, and this is a rather provocative one that has been ascribed to you, that behind you apparently said, behind every writer stands an unhappy childhood.
I did say that, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because I think that all writers tend to look back on their childhood as a period of intense dissatisfaction, if not morbid unhappiness. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't be writers. There has to be an enormous gift for introspection in the person who writes. I spoke a little nostalgically and longingly about wishing I could have been a cheerleader. And had I been a cheerleader, I certainly wouldn't have been writing poems in the dark, as it were.
So where were you between dissatisfaction and morbid unhappiness?
Probably right in the middle.
Uh-huh. So what happened that you moved from the closet poet, as you describe yourself, to a published and very well-regarded poet?
Well, I joined a poetry workshop at the Boston Center for Adult Education, which was run by John Holmes, who was a poet and professor at Tufts, and early on became my mentor. And under his hired sympathy, I was able to develop as a poet.
And be able to say your work out loud and hope for a publisher?
Yes, all of those things. Actually, after I think a year or two at the Boston Center, a few of us splintered off, Anne Sexton, George Starbuck, Sam Albert, John Holmes, and me, and we had our own poetry workshop for many years. We met in one another's houses every other week from about 58 till 1962.
Wow. And you read each other's
work? We read each other's work. We commented, we criticized, we attacked, we praised, we drank, we were noisy. My kids used to say, oh, you're having company, who's coming? And I'd say, no, it's just the workshop. And they would groan and say, oh, not the poets. Can we go sleep in the room over the garage? Meaning it was going to be so noisy, they wouldn't be able to sleep.
Does that mean you argued about poetry?
We did. We fought passionately about it.
About
and then there
what?
Would be angry exchanges of letters the next day, back and forth, saying, I think George talked too much, I think Anne hogged the stage, etc.
So how did this help you all as poets?
I think it helped enormously. We all got a book out of it. I mean, we were all writing a book at that time, even though we didn't realize it, perhaps.
When you're asked that question, well, what do? What do you say?
Well, I usually say, we have a farm and we raise horses. I don't usually admit I'm a poet.
Why not?
Well, because if you say you're a poet, the next question invariably is, oh, have you ever published anything? if you said you were a lawyer, they wouldn't ask you if you'd ever tried a case. And if you said you were a doctor, then your credentials would absolutely speak for themselves. But to say you're a poet is kind of a self-styled vocation. And therefore, it's a little bit suspect.
Maxine Cumin, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Maxine Cumin is poet laureate of New Hampshire. She won a Pulitzer for her poetry back in 1973. Her latest book is entitled Women, Animals, and Vegetables. This is Fresh Air.